When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about the birth of the SAS, that British Special Forces unit that served with distinction in North Africa, was disbanded after the war, but is now at the heart, once again, of Britain's Special Forces. It's a story shrouded in myth, in legend. But it's a story we've covered before on this podcast. We've interviewed several great historians on this topic. One of whom is Ben McIntyre, who's joining me again on the podcast today because he wrote the book on which the new TV hit series Rogue Heroes is based. A new dramatisation of the early years of the SAS. It's a fantastic bit of historical drama. People have been arguing about its authenticity. People, yet again, not quite getting the memo. The fact that it's there, dramatised, lots of actors playing the parts, reciting script written by a contemporary writer means that it's not actually a historical document. It's not a textbook. So don't panic, folks. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. It's a wonderful imagining of the start of the SAS, which, yes, is rooted in great history written by Ben McIntyre and others, but it's also a place where creativity is allowed to flourish, both the writing, which is fantastic, and the acting, which is great as well. Now, I'm going to ask Ben McIntyre about the show because it's based on his work. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But I really want to ask him about Robert Blair Mayne, a.k.a. Paddy Mayne. He ended the war as Lieutenant Colonel. He won 3 Distinguished Service Orders, highly decorated, founder member of the SAS. That followed a pre-war life of playing rugby for Ireland and the British Lions, going on a South Africa tour, in which it was always said that he relaxed by wrecking hotels and fighting dockers. He's brilliantly portrayed by Jack O'Connell in the TV series, who's created one of the most extraordinarily engaging characters that I can think of in any British drama recently. But how much did that tell us about the original Paddy Mayne? I'm going to get Ben McIntyre to talk me through the career of this extraordinary and very elusive man. Blair Mayne died, sadly, at just 40 in 1955 from a car crash in his native Newtownards in Northern Ireland. He's a figure that I've been obsessed with really since I first started making TV shows and came across him in my early 20s. The only man surviving from that time is Mike Sadler. He's now over 100 years old. I was lucky enough to interview him as well. You can hear that interview on the podcast if you look at the feed. I broadcast that a few days ago, so please go and have a listen to that. But in the meantime, here is the best-selling author, the fantastically nice Ben McIntyre. He's long been a friend. I'm so glad one of his books has been turned into such a thrilling drama. Here's Ben McIntyre talking about the early SAS and Robert Blair Mayne. Enjoy.
T-10. Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first and black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Ben McIntyre, thank you very much for coming back on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you. It's such a fun TV series, this, isn't it?
Oh, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Dan. I loved it. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I don't have to. I'm not under contract to say that. And I think they've done an amazing job with SAS. And it's not a particularly easy one to do because so many people feel invested in the SAS. There is so much mythology surrounding the SAS that it's a tricky prospect in some ways. And I think what Steve Knight has done brilliantly is to kind of remain true to the spirit of the whole thing, without trying to glamorize war or the SAS or the brutality of what was going on. Because actually, I mean, not all of your listeners would have got that far, but once you get to the end of the final episode, you realise that these people are being chewed up by war in some ways. It's not a particularly sort of dignifying or glorious escapade. It's actually incredibly damaging for everybody.
And also, there is so much luck. The idea that if you're looking for kind of superheroes in the past, people who could shape the course of nations and battles, you get the strong impression here, which I'm sure you had in your research, that, goodness me, we're all just flotsam on a great sea of luck. Some of our decisions work, some of them don't. We get away with it, and sometimes we don't get away with it. And you really see that in this story.
Yeah, and there's that brilliant line that Steve Knight has crafted in it, where the main character, David Sterling, says most of war is complete chaos. Mostly, we don't know what's going on. It's all about accident and fate and luck, or lack of it. It's so interesting, isn't it? And people often ask me, you know, how much did the SAS really make a difference in North Africa? And of course, that's an impossible question to answer. It's like any sort of counterfactual question is, you have to ask, well, what would have happened if they hadn't been there? But it's pretty clear that they did degrade the sort of Axis air power in that part of North Africa at a critical moment. And perhaps even more importantly, they created a kind of morale-boosting operation that was hugely important. And Churchill was completely across that, as was Sterling. I mean, one of the interesting things about going through the archive was the number of photographs in there, in which it is quite clear the SAS participants knew that they were going to be important figures in history, and they are dressed for the part. They look like a rock band that have just come off stage. You know, they're wearing this kind of variety of headgear, they're wearing the bandoliers, they're touting all sorts of different kinds of weaponry, because they know they're being photographed and they know they're part of posterity. And they also know that they're having an effect on the war and the fighting machine at a time when, of course, the war in North Africa was not going well. And this myth, this instant legend of the kind of phantom warriors coming in, these rogue heroes coming in from the desert and sort of destroying and then disappearing back, that had a hugely powerful effect, which, of course, is impossible to measure.
I know that it's based on your book, but what strikes me about the TV series is actually, it may or may not be perfectly accurate, but it's a combination of brilliant artists, both the actors and the writer, coming together with wonderful producers, and is inspired by your work to produce something quite different, which is a piece of art, which isn't history. And, you know, you shouldn't be tested on it in your A-level or your undergrad, but it's wonderful and there to be enjoyed. Like Turner's painting of Hannibal crossing the Alps. I mean, that's not what it actually looked like. Or like Shakespeare's Henry V, right? It's there to be enjoyed and stimulate and excite. And hopefully people go and read your book. But you look at this and you don't think that's exactly what happened on those days, right?
No, absolutely not. And nor should you, I think. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of nonsense talked about, you know, the accuracy of films and da da da. Look, if suddenly Steve had turned around and this unit was entirely American, yeah, you'd have a very good reason for kicking up a stink. But the truth is, this is a different art form. This is a completely different sort of operation that is going on here. And it's translating reality into something that is an emotional reality. It's not a literal reality. And it's so funny, the people on Twitter sort of steaming around about, oh, is it a perfectly accurate portrayal of Paddy Mayne? It's not meant to be. It's a different thing that's going on here. And I think you're absolutely right. If it interests people in the history, and look, I would say this as the writer of the book on which it's based, to me, that series demands that you go and read the book. It's got that wonderful disclaimer at the beginning that says the things that seem most impossible in this story are mostly true. And that to me says, right, go and read the book, because if you want to find out what really happened, the book will tell you. And he's quite right about that, that I think that it sort of in a way embraces the difference between the genres in a completely honest way. Look, it has a rocking soundtrack. It's got AC/DC as you're going into the desert. Of course, that's not, you know, they were going into the sounds of, well, they weren't going to the sounds of anything, actually, but if they were hearing anything, it was probably Vera Lynn. But I think that's a brilliant embracing of the idea that this isn't supposed to be a kind of documentary operation. It's a way of translating the past into the present in a way that lots more people can understand and get a handle on. And if there's one thing that you do brilliantly, Dan, on this podcast, and things that I try and do, it's to say to people, history isn't a dusty story of facts and figures and movements and great men necessarily. It's about character and personality and accident and emotion and all sorts of things that we in the 21st century can sort of get our heads around. And I think he's done a brilliant job of that.
I completely agree. I love watching it, and I don't feel that my understanding of the Second World War is somehow being corrupted by it. All it has had me doing is walking around swearing a lot. It's just had me embrace my inner swearing.
Your inner swearing. No, it's brilliant on that. Again, not entirely untrue to life, actually. I don't think there'd have been quite as much swearing by and in front of officers, but my goodness, I mean, the potty mouths were there from the beginning. I think that's exactly right. Look, and films have always done that. The screen has always done that. The moment the war was over, we saw a flood of black and white movies that were not literal representations of what was going on during the war. They were stories that allowed the tellers to tell them in a way that their audience could get an emotional grip on. The Longest Day is not a documentary. The Great Escape is miles from being a documentary. All those Colditz stories, they're not literal reality. They're something much more profound in some ways. They're broader in a way. I mean, what's so interesting about the SAS Rogue Heroes series is that it's the demographic is very young. Perhaps that's unsurprising in some way, but, you know, we think of the war as being grandpa's war, that it's only going to be watched by sort of men over 60 in red trousers. That is not the case. That is not what's happened with this series. It's being watched by young people, not all of them male. I mean, it's a very interestingly broad audience. Lots of people of a sort of younger generation are thinking, this is actually very interesting and stylish and strange and sort of unpredictable.
I think those three adjectives are precisely correct. It's stylish, it's strange, unpredictable. It's a lovely piece of filmmaking. But as the historian, I certainly don't want to get into a debate about what's true and what isn't, but Paddy Mayne feels like he's coming out of this. He dominates the screen. I think that actor's portrayal of Paddy Mayne is actually one of the great performances and characters I've seen in British filmmaking in decades. Sometimes he is literally like Achilles in his tent, sort of in the desert. I mean, it's too brilliant sometimes. Let's talk about the real Paddy Mayne, because I'm glad a new generation are being introduced to Blair Mayne, because what an extraordinary character. He would have won eternal renown even as a rugby player had the Second World War not happened. But tell me a little bit about him. He isn't quite as portrayed as a sort of a horny-handed son of the soil, is he, in the show? Tell me about the real Blair Mayne.
No, that is slightly exaggerated. I mean, Paddy Mayne is a very, very complicated and still very controversial figure. You know, he is much debated, including elements of his story that some find very difficult, including his sexuality. I mean, there is good reason to believe that Paddy Mayne was probably a repressed homosexual, and that part of his rage may have come from that. Now, that doesn't seem to me to be a terribly controversial thing to say these days, but there are people who find that anathema. So yes, he's a complicated figure. He isn't quite the kind of working class toughy that he's portrayed as in the film. He actually came from a really quite well-to-do Protestant middle-class family. He was sort of privately educated in Northern Ireland. I mean, he wasn't out of the same draw that David Sterling was out of. I mean, David Sterling was a proper full-blown aristocrat, really. And he did in some ways even more patrician than he is portrayed in the film. I mean, he was quite snobbish, old David Sterling, which doesn't really come out in the series. But Paddy Mayne is very, very complicated. You'll see as the series develops that Paddy changes over time during the war, and you'll see him develop as a character somewhat away from this kind of vulpine figure that he is in the first series. I mean, he becomes in some ways even more complicated. That explosive fury, sometimes directed against his closest friends. I mean, that was the strange thing about Paddy Mayne, is that he was an extraordinary warrior. He was utterly nerveless. He was able to inspire in other people levels of courage that they had no idea that they could tap. So in that way, he was an absolutely born leader. But if you got him at the wrong moment in the mess and he'd had 6 whiskies too many, he was quite liable to pick you up and throw you into the fireplace, because there was this perceived slight that you wouldn't even have said. I mean, even his closest friends were very, very wary of Mayne. There was a level of unexploded ordnance going on inside that very complicated character that lasted all of his very short life. I mean, Paddy Mayne was one of those people, I think, who maybe he would have gone on to a great rugby career, but he was one of those people who I think probably could not survive in peacetime. He found it very difficult. And the latter part of his life is, in a way, very tragic, I think. I mean, he's one of those people who could never find rest.
You listen to Dan Snow's History. We're talking about the early SAS, particularly Paddy Mayne. More coming up.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on my podcast, Not Just the Tudors, from History Hit, we talk about everything. From what Queen Consort Camilla could learn from the Renaissance?
Really, when we begin to look at queen consorts, we notice that there's a lot of ways that women could have authority through their relationship with the king.
To how you should never upstage Henry VIII.
You'd have been a very unwise individual turning up to court, probably with a larger codpiece than the king, I suspect.
From the real Matawaka, better known as Pocahontas.
She's brought and presented to the king and queen as this shining example of what we could achieve.
To how to tell someone to get lost.
You could say, turd in your teeth.
In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There. Between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places. But you will be. If you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He studies as a medic in Ireland?
Well, I think originally he was a medic, but his career was as a lawyer, actually. I mean, he studied law.
And he played rugby for Ireland and the British and Irish Lions.
Yeah, famously. I mean, his exploits while on tour with the Lions are legend, but like most legend, largely true. I mean, at one point, he actually went out and shot a springbok, which he then dumped the corpse on the bed of one of his fellow players and then took it out again and left it outside the South African coach's door. I mean, he was pretty uncontrollable even then. But he was a brilliant rugby player.
And the South Africans, and this is saying something, said they'd almost never met a man with his sort of visceral rage on the pitch. I mean, that is quite terrifying.
I think he would have lasted today about 5 minutes before the red card would have come out. I don't think he'd have been able to play today.
Yeah, that's right. And because he was an amateur boxing champion, I think, or certainly medalist, wasn't he?
Well, he certainly boxed. I mean, actually, the champion of the SAS team was a man called Reg Seekings, who is brilliantly played in the series, who was a brilliant boxer. I mean, again, another very unchained sort of personality.
Then Blair Mayne ends up fighting initially the Vichy French in the Middle East. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So he distinguished himself, first of all, in sort of commando operations on the Litani River. I think he won his first DSO there. So he was already a pretty established soldier and sort of leader by the time he arrived in North Africa, which is part of why he had a kind of lingering animus towards the French. you know, because he'd spent the first part of his war killing them. So that conflict with the French SAS troop as they come out is pretty close to life. I mean, Paddy Mayne was one of those people who was not above stereotyping entire nations. And again, that comes out too.
And he was a poet.
He was a poet. He wrote poetry and he read a lot of poetry and he could recite from memory a lot of A.E. Housman and others, perhaps less fashionable today than they were then. There was an Irish soul in him. There was definitely a kind of deeper figure. And in a way, that was one of the things that drew him to Stirling. I mean, their relationship was very acrid, very conflictual a lot of the time, but they were not entirely unlike in character. Stirling himself had wanted to be an artist and had trained to be an artist and had painted in Paris and saw himself, you know, he used to go around in a beret and, you know, a smock trying to look like an artist, but failed utterly. You know, it didn't work for him. And I think that was part of his disappointment and fury. And it's clearly part of Paddy Mayne's story as well, is that there was a sort of softer soul inside this furious, antagonistic figure. But there was somebody who was capable of great reflection and thought and of deep affection too. I mean, I think that his relationship with Owen McGonagall in the TV series is brilliantly done, because there was a love going on there. And whether it was a sexual love or not is, of course, we don't know. And it's none of our business in some ways. But I think it deals brilliantly with that. And I've tried in the book to deal with that in the same way. It's not a straightforward thing. But the death of Owen McGonagall had a very profound effect on Paddy Mayne.
And sadly, the wonderful story about him being sort of found in a prison cell is possibly one where the myth is a bit shy of the mark. Is that right?
Yes, possibly. That was one of the issues with trying to tell this story, was that it is very encrusted in myth. I mean, there is a great deal of legend, and many of those legends were retold by the participants themselves as fact. And so you then bump up against, which I'm sure you've had many times in your work, that you're dealing with memory, and memory is such a fallible quality, really. You know, so David Stirling would tell stories of breaking into headquarters on his crutches and hiding them and so on. And is that true? Well, it's certainly, he believed it was true, and he told it so many times that he was convinced that it was true. Now, does that make it necessarily actually true? Well, possibly not. But, you know, that is what you get when you're dealing with oral history of this sort that then becomes written history. And in fact, Paddy Mayne himself never propagated the idea that he'd been picked up in a prison by Stirling. He certainly was arrested, and he undoubtedly thumped his senior officer. That is fact. Whether Stirling picked him up immediately after that is not quite clear. But it's a story that was told and retold so many times that it is part of the SAS story.
We should say, as you've developed in your book and the new series will show, Paddy Mayne consistently didn't get the VC, despite doing things that simply read like a Hollywood storyline, like just wandering about. As everyone else is, you know, hiding in ditches, he's just sort of wandering about in open sight of the enemy, showing astonishing lack of regard for his own safety. And that he seems to do that all the time. Why do you think he never got the VC?
Well, I'm among the group that thinks that he absolutely should have had a VC. And I'm in pretty distinguished company there. I mean, Montgomery himself recommended him for a VC. I think in the end, what happened was that Paddy was just too volatile. His reputation was just so extreme that I think there was probably an unwritten, unspoken feeling that he just couldn't be given this thing because he was just too wild. There is a sort of technical issue in all of this as well, which is that you needed to have two eyewitness reports to what had happened, and this related to a particular event that had taken place towards the end of the war, the actual episode for which he was recommended for the VC. My recollection is that there was only one witness and that this was a technical reason why he could not be awarded it. That looked to me like an excuse. One hesitates to say this. I think there may have been an element of homophobia to it as well. I think the stories of Paddy Mayne's sexuality had got out. They were known about and they were current at this time. And there may have been an element of that involved.
Recently, there's been some criticism of Stirling. How central is sort of Mayne to the SAS? I mean, is he really in some ways the true central protagonist of this story of the birth of the SAS?
I think one has to be very wary of the revisionist stuff about Stirling. I mean, It's quite funny in a way, because nobody was ever claiming that Sterling was some kind of saint. I mean, he's clearly an extremely flawed character. And the idea that somehow, you know, knocking him down as a phony major or whatever, I mean, seems a bit excessive to me. I think most sensible accounts of this regiment give equal credit, if that's the right word, to Sterling, to Paddy Mayne, and also to Jock Lewis. I mean, Jock Lewis was absolutely central to the foundation of this. I mean, he was in many ways the original architect of it. So I think it took a combination, and we're so quick, aren't we, these days, to apportion blame or credit to one person. It's almost as if history's become sort of moral accountancy in some ways, that we have to go back, and if X is responsible, then Y cannot be responsible. Or if X gets credit, then Y cannot also be credited with it. And it's the same way with all sorts of movements in history. You know, the SAS is a good thing or a bad thing. It can't be a combination of good things and bad things. And I think the SAS was born through a combination of Sterling's connections and determination, Jock Lewis's rigid cleverness and his willingness to sort of think about how you were actually going to go about blowing up planes in the desert. I mean, he invented the Lewis bomb. And Paddy Mayne's feral ability to lead from the front and to do things and inspire others to do things that were not only not sensible, they were at times extremely bonkers. But I think it is quite possible for the SAS to have been born out of all these three things. And I think to make it into a sort of zero-sum game is a bit mad, actually.
For people that have enjoyed and binged the whole series, like me, tell us, as the man who did the history that it's based on, what are some of the maddest things in it that are, in fact, reasonably true?
Well, there's that moment when Paddy Mayne spots that, and this is a bit of a plot spoiler, but spots a party taking place in the mess hut on one of the airstrips, and there are Italian and German soldiers sitting there drinking and listening to the gramophone records. And he really did just kick the door open with two other soldiers with Tommy guns and simply killed a lot of them. I mean, some consider it to have been extremely cold-blooded. Even Sterling was deeply shocked by that episode. I mean, I found, it had never been published before, but I found an account written by Sterling in later life in which he said that was a really bad moment. I mean, Paddy went completely over the top there. But actually, in some ways, the incident was even more sort of chaotic and carnage than it appears on screen. I mean, that was absolutely true. And the competition between Sterling and Mayne was absolutely right. I mean, they became completely locked into this sort of personal struggle over who was going to blow up more stuff. Again, the first parachute jump that Sterling and Jock Lewis made, I mean, it looks extraordinary where the two of them simply tie their release cords to the legs of the chairs inside the wrong kind of plane. It was a postal plane. It wasn't a parachute plane. And simply jump out of the door. That is true. That absolutely happened. And Sterling's parachute caught on the tail fin and down he plummeted at roughly four times the recommended speed. Amazing that he survived it. So all of those things are true. But then it seems to me that the things that are not strictly factual are perfectly acceptable too. I mean, you know, there is this love affair with a French spy that takes place at the heart of the story. Did it happen? I strongly doubt it. Does it add hugely to the pleasure and fun and engagement of the story? Absolutely. So that's just fine with me.
I'm glad to hear there's going to be a second series. Ben, if people wish to read the history that all this is based on, how can they do that?
Well, it's very, very simple. They go to the best bookshops and buy a copy of SAS Rogue Heroes. It's delightful to see that it's having a second life, this book. It's been absolutely wonderful, the power of television, to watch a whole new readership sort of picking up on this. And I think, as I said before, I do think that the series really asks you, if you're interested in this subject, go and have a look. Go and take a look at not just my book. There are other books about this subject. It's a wonderful, colourful history, and it'll be fascinating to see what they do with season two and three and going forwards.
I found the depiction of Cairo fascinating. I've talked to lots of veterans who do talk about Cairo. It's the thing, as you know, it's hardest to get the veterans to talk about because, you know, it's sex and it's venereal disease and it's drinking. It's just, I like to push and then I get pushed back and so you can't. But they do occasionally say it was like Sodom and Gomorrah. And I found that engaging as well.
But you touch on a very important subject there, Dan, because actually the fun side of war is something that is very difficult to write about. And the SAS is part of this story. Part of wartime is incredibly exciting and fun and young and glamorous and unleashed. And that goes for life in Cairo as well. You know, the wartime world revolving around Shepherd's Hotel in Cairo was enormously good fun. And actually, I was very delighted to see Anthony Beaver, for whom I have huge respect, doing a review of Rogue Heroes the other day, in which he knows a lot about wartime Cairo, saying that he felt that the whole series had sort of captured something very elemental in that story. But I think it is also part of war. It is such a lurid, violent, stressful thing, combat, that of course people outside of those moments would seek relief and pleasure and release. And that happens in all sorts of different ways. They didn't all curl up with a book of poetry.
Thank you, Ben. I am going to go and curl up with a book of history written by you. So thank you very much, dude, for coming back on this podcast. You've been such a friend to us over the years.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you, Dan.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.